Don't answer it.
Don't answer it.
Don't answer it. Your name is in this book. It could happen to you. It starts as a game, and there's no end in fright.
Go ahead. Close your eyes and pick a name. Pick a name? Any name.
I saw what you did, and I know who you are.
I saw what you did. I know who you are.
The dial clicks, and a terror mounts. Don't answer it. See it.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, and welcome everyone to another podcast of the Forgotten Horrors series. And we've ranged a little bit beyond the books that have given this podcast its name. But we think that maybe that's a good idea, that we can cover some stuff in the podcast that maybe aren't covered in the books. And we'll be talking about the books, of course, a little bit later on. And, Michael, I know that there's a couple of new ones coming up, right?
Man, I tell you what, I think this 40th anniversary year for the Forgotten Horrors brand has probably loosen some triggers that might ought to have stayed shut. What do you do? About a quarter of the way through volume 13 of Forgotten Horrors.
Nice. Very nice. And I'm so happy to see those doing well, too. They're doing well. We're getting a lot of orders. We want to thank the folks that are listening to the podcast that have been ordering them and ordering the little spinoff book that we did also, Fantasies in the Sand.
One that has earned its keep.
Well, we'll talk about those a little bit later. Right now, we've got some William Castle to deal with, and I know William Castle was a good friend of your uncle's, the showman, your Uncle Grady. And this actually is from 1965, the same year that Universal, he did this picture for Universal, the same year that Universal released The Nightwalker, which we've talked about on this podcast before. This came out a couple of months after Nightwalker. Officially, I think Nightwalker was March and this one was May, or maybe it was vice versa. They're very close. And this is called I Saw What You Did. And it is upon... Well, let me tell you my impressions, first of all. Well, let me give a very quick synopsis. A couple of young girls and one of their younger sisters, a couple of young teenagers, I should say, and their younger sister and a younger sister, left to their own devices one night, start making prank phone calls, telling the people on the other end, I saw what you did and I know who you are. And, of course, they end up calling a psycho who just happens to have murdered his wife, played by John Ireland, the psycho, of course, who's no stranger in these quarters at all. We talked about him in that day, that really weird day of the nightmare a few months ago.
Correct, yes.
And like that film, this is a little bit of a psycho knockoff. So at any rate, that's kind of what happens, and that's under William Castle. What are your impressions of the picture? What's this picture about, Michael? Because I got my ideas that there's a little bit of an underpinning to this.
It's Castle trying to not only emulate Hitchcock, but also Castle trying to cling to that youth market that he is seeing at the time, seeing American International hogging.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of teenage protagonists, even though they're not really the protagonists, they're very prominent, and they of course are the provocation for the horrors that follow.
And the viewpoint characters as well, of course.
And the viewpoint characters, which makes the film very close kin to an earlier Castle piece of totally supernatural inclinations called 13 Ghosts. And it's not a particularly graceful handling of teenage life, but it was a big hit with the teeny boppers in its day.
You know, I see it, and again, I don't want to get all grad school on you or anything, but I see it as our producer Joy Hambrick, Joy and I have talked about this. It's a kind of a loss of innocence picture, where one of the female, the teenage protagonist, is sort of lamenting to her friend, and now it seems like everything I want is someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this is, it's in its way, I mean, it reminds you, oddly, of a lot of things. It reminds me a little bit of Blue Velvet, when
funny thing about that, but go ahead, yes.
Well, all of a sudden, the protagonist or the viewpoint characters find themselves like enmeshed in something that's so far beyond what their world has consisted of that they just don't even know how to deal with it.
Well, Castle did Alienation very well.
Yes, yes.
And he anticipated a lot. That sense of failed fulfillment is also what drives the teenage daughter in 13 Ghosts.
That's true. That's Joe Morrow, isn't it? There's Joe Morrow playing it.
Yeah, exactly. And into a near affair with the bad guy.
That's true. I'd forgotten.
It's quite amazing. Yeah. And, of course, you talk about anticipating Blue Velvet. Well, loss of innocence is at the heart of that sort of thing. The other close-in-time Castle picture with Joan Crawford, you go back and look at that, Straitjacket, and you will see that it anticipates almost note for note the situation in Sling Blade.
Really? Well, I've not thought about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, the incarcerated axe-murdering maniac finally discharged, pronounced cured, to return to a very disorienting home life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, here's a person who has spent a generation of her life in the nut house.
Right.
And does that not sound like something Billy Bob Thornton might dream up
exactly.
And, of course, elaborate on?
Exactly.
And the arc of the film, not to give away too much, is a full circle return to the sheltering confines of the asylum.
And in this case, and I saw what you did, it's a return to the sheltering confines of the home.
Of the bourgeois normal.
Although it will be forever changed because it's been invaded by someone who looks like John Ireland.
Just like Kyle MacLachlan at the end of Blue Velvet.
Exactly.
It's like, well, there's the first sign of spring sitting on our window. But look, it's a mechanical bird.
That's true. I remember when I was working for the Tulsa World, I got into the worst argument with a guy about that bird, about whether it was supposed to be mechanical or not. And he actually got up and just stormed out in a huff about that damn bird.
And, oh, mercy.
You know, and people, you know, well, people will do those sorts of things. I'll tell you something else. Speaking of birds, I'll tell you something else it kind of reminded me of at the beginning, because the tone of this picture is a little bit uneven. Even right to the end credits, where there's not even, we won't spoil it for people who haven't seen it, but there's not an end credit. It's just a goofy, different end credit. But at the very beginning with those eyes, and the girls on the bed with the phones, it looks like Bye Bye Birdie to me.
Yeah.
It's got like that look of the Apple Valley teens, whoever those people were, right?
I think that's a deliberate ploy on Castle's part.
Do you think it's also deliberate? It's got to be, doesn't it? And again, we don't want to give away the farm here, but there is a shower scene, and I saw what you did, that mm-hmm. has a sex role reversal, basically, in it, and not a murder role reversal in terms of gender, but it has a kind of a role reversal where the person in the shower is the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
You suppose that was something that William Castle thought was a good idea to do?
I think he loved to twist expectations to a point where you didn't even know what you were doing there.
Well, true, and he also
these characters don't know what they're doing in the movie.
No,
the actors, of course, do, but their characters are entirely off balance. That is one of the most shocking murder scenes I can recall.
It's very shocking. Absolutely.
Like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Joan Crawford, against expectations once again, has nothing to do with any of the mayhem except to know what went on.
Which gives it a rear window.
Yeah, so she's not the only one who saw what you did mm-hmm. or knows who you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like these kids, and of course the twisted involvements that result. Like in Rear Window, there's one is surprised, of course, to learn that Robert Block had nothing to do with this film,
except maybe
influencing the attitude.
Right, because it was William McGivern, who was basically a police procedural novelist before he came to Hollywood and did some pretty nice stuff.
The novel came from Ursula Curtis.
Popular
novel. In fact, her stuff kept showing up in films the remake in 1988 of I Saw What You Did. With Dear Shawnee Smith.
Right. And that was that made for TV? Was that a made for TV film?
That was made for television.
Yes,
yeah,
I was thinking.
And it feels like it. And it's like, why bother?
Right.
It should have been held for the new Dark Castle tribute series, which is not so much a tribute after all as it is an exploitation of Castle's name.
Right. Well, I will tell you that according to William Castle's autobiography, the Step Right Up autobiography, he claimed that he needed Joan Crawford, or he needed a major name for a cameo in the picture. And really, I guess it's kind of an extended cameo, isn't it? I mean, she's on screen for less than 10 minutes totally.
That's correct. However, she lends that air.
Right.
Picture.
And she's top billed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now the other ones, it's funny because one of the deals was, well, both of these young women were in high school and this was their first movie role, which is technically correct. And the one of them, that's true, Sarah Lane, was not really, I mean, she was in high school, but her folks were both actors. Rusty Lane, the old character actor. And her mother, Sarah Anderson, is actually in Straight Jacket. I'm sorry, in I Saw What You Did, as the family, one of the women, as the husband and wife. She's the wife that are entertaining the family on that business deal when the husband and wife leave the girls to their own devices. That's Sarah Lane's mom, and she later on, you know, she did it. She had a recurring role on Maverick. And she did a couple of, the last two Billy Jacks, I think she's in. And then she did that scurrilous film with Gary Kent called Schoolgirls in Chains.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yes, in 73. Now, the other girl who's, I just lost her name. She actually, Sarah Lane became Russell Lane. I mean, she was still a female, and she,
right.
You know, but she did, there was no anything just beyond the name change. But she actually had a pretty decent career. The other girl didn't do all that much.
Oh, Andy Carey.
Carey. She did a couple of things, but not all that much. So they really were high school girls. But again, that's a little bit of a Castle exaggeration, because Sarah Lane came from two actors, and she lived in Los Angeles. So she was she had been around the block. I'm sure she knew how to do a line reading. And then the third younger girl in there, she never really did all that much either. But the interesting thing to me about Joan Crawford's, well, there's a lot of interesting things about Joan Crawford's appearance in this. She's, depending on what resource you go to, she's either pushing 60 or has crossed the barrier, and she's still playing like this sort of romantic lead, more or less, in there. And, you know, this is her last American film, unless you count the Oscar. I mean, she had an unbilled thing where you kind of see her in the Oscar, which is a whole different story. And then she went to England and did, what, Trog and Berserk, which a lot of people think were Castle films as well, but were not.
Herman Cohen. And of course, Cohen was another pretender to that Master of Suspense title.
Right. Do you remember, was it 90, when Sam Arkoff was at the USA Film Festival?
Oh, yeah.
And I asked him a question. He was taking questions after I Was a Teenage Werewolf. We had been able to have dinner with him, which was a wonderful experience, Paul McSpadden and I. And so he was taking questions, and he had just shown I Was a Teenage Werewolf. And I said something about Herman Cohen said this about the film. And, boy, it stopped him dead in his tracks, Michael. It was like, well, if Herman Cohen said it, of course it must be true if Herman Cohen said it. Obviously, their relationship had soured somewhere along the line.
Cohen got too big for his britches. Castle wanted to keep making the teenage monster pictures, and Cohen got kind of pseudo-intellectual.
You're talking about Arkoff wanted to keep making them? Is that what you
mean? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, they were, and Cohen, of course, wanted to keep making them.
Uh-huh.
And, in fact, what is Horrors of the Black Museum if not I Was a Teenage Jekyll and Hyde?
Good point. Good point.
Herman told me once that his original title for Conga was I Was a Teenage Gorilla.
Is that right?
And I don't think he was woofing. And of course his documented working title for Blood of Dracula is I Was a Teenage Daughter of Dracula.
Really? I did not know that. It doesn't surprise me.
Those original conceptual titles would have delighted Arkoff.
Well, yeah.
But Cohen got the art film bug fairly early after making some, you know, teenage exploitation mm-hmm. pictures of no small clout. And he aligned himself. He shifted his allegiance from American International over to Anglo Amalgamated,
right? Which was kind of a second string hammer at that point, right?
Which was, yeah, exactly. And of course had a deal, a releasing deal with American International.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's where
to meet Cohen, you'd have thought you were talking to a born and bred Oxfordian.
Oh,
he
really?
Assimilated that thoroughly.
I did not know that. Did you interview him several times then over the course of his career?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And
did he pick up like a British accent and stuff?
And not so much the accent as the attitude.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And of course an Oxfordian accent is not really that much of an accent.
I guess that's probably true, yeah.
It's an amazing thing. Of course, good old Sam Arkoff, he remained the Yiddish exploitation film architect to the very end.
Boy, did he ever. I remember at that dinner we were talking about, he was telling us that his wife was there as well, and he was telling us that his wife's favorite film that he'd done was Angel, Angel, Down We Go, and we started talking about all these pictures, and he said something to me that I will never forget. He says, I was a teenage werewolf. $100,000 picture, $1 million title.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, and his wife at one point says, Sam, we've got to go now. You're going to have a very upset wife. And he goes, but honey, these guys know more about my films than I do. He loved people talking about those pictures.
That was
like one of the high points of my fanboy life, was getting to have dinner with Sam Arkoff. But
he and
Castle were a lot alike in some ways, but he and Castle never worked together, did they? Am I missing anything? I don't think they did.
No, but they were, at least in Arkoff's view, bitter rivals.
Yeah, that's what I would think. And
Castle counted himself unique.
How was his relationship with, in terms of Hitchcock? What was that dynamic like?
Hitchcock was aloof. Mm-hmm. Not that he didn't recognize competition, but he wouldn't have had that competition if Castle hadn't announced himself as competition.
And he did announce himself as competition for Hitchcock.
Oh yeah, even to the point of imitating the rambling narrated trailers and introductions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even to the point of posturing himself as the director. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean the silhouette. The distinctive silhouette. Okay, where did that come? Gosh, I think Hitchcock did something like that.
I think he may have done something like that on television.
And of course, it was the biggest Hitchcock connection of all was when Castle landed Robert Block.
Right.
Because
sure.
Block wouldn't have had a long term chance with Hitchcock.
Because
he wasn't really a screenwriter yet. Hitchcock had his own favorite screenwriters.
Right.
But Castle recognized the name value of Block and put him to work on what a lot of people consider Psycho knockoffs.
Mm-hmm. Including, of course, Homicidal, the biggest one in a bunch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I remember Rob White telling me, an interview I did for Fangoria years ago, Rob White was quite a character. And he said that for the longest time, Castle wouldn't let him watch Psycho. And and while he was writing the screenplay to Homicidal, and then he finally watched it, he said he'd stolen the whole damn thing from Psycho.
Well,
he said, this is what I want you to do, right? And then Rob White wrote it. And he said it was his complete knockoff.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if Bob Wills could do it with San Antonio Rose.
Well, sure. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Take an established melody and a structure and rework it just enough to make an original new piece.
And that's what happened with Homicidal, which is not a bad picture.
It's got a really absurd finale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But if you buy into the picture, it's a shocker.
Right. It absolutely is. Well, there's a couple of things. I went back when I knew that we were going to be talking about this picture. I went back to my copy of Step Right Up. And, you know, you always have to take William Castle's stuff that he says about himself and his movies pretty much cum grano salis. I remember Rob White telling me that when he was on the Columbia lot, that of course when Rob White had come from scripting the Men of Annapolis series, Ziv TV?
And well, yeah, that's right.
And then he had gone to start working with William Castle at Columbia. I think Macabre was his first film. And he said Castle would have a driver, and he'd be driving around the lot talking on a telephone, and the cord went nowhere. It was just a cord that was just, there was not to plug into or anything, but he was always talking, right, as he'd go by.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to remember that, but he did say in terms of, about this picture, he said every morning he would play the two young women, a jingle, "Don't laugh, little girl. Better run for your life. The man you just talked to has murdered his wife." He would play that every morning, the jingle for them, and then he said he would also have them make real prank phone calls so that they could get into the deal. He also said, you know, the gimmick that he had for this one didn't really, there weren't a lot, it seems like it didn't happen in a lot of theaters, maybe just the major theaters or something, but there were seat belts for this picture where you could belt yourself in and so that you wouldn't, I guess, jump out of your seat when the scary stuff happened. But he said the first gimmick he had was telephones. He tied up with telephone companies all around America and put huge plastic phones in front of each theater and then put newspaper phone numbers in newspaper ads. And when you called the phone number, a girl's voice, he said, and I'm quoting from the book, and I answered and whispered sexily, "I saw what you did, and I know who you are," and then made a date to meet the potential customer at whatever local theater was showing the picture. Well, he says, the whole gimmick would have worked beautifully, except the teenagers of America took the phone game seriously. While I had expected some reaction, I wasn't prepared for what happened, and neither was the phone company. It seemed that almost every teenager in the country was on the phone, making crank calls by the thousands, jamming the phone lines. And later on, he says that the phone company even threatened to disconnect his home phone because of this. Now, I suspect a little bit of showmanship hyperbole in that, don't you?
I think that's, carrying it a bit far. You know, the funny thing, Castle had largely abandoned the gimmicks by now because suddenly the theater owners were rebelling.
Right. Was that what it was? It wasn't because he thought he had outgrown it or anything? It was because of the theater owners?
No, it was because the theaters kept, he kept making his gimmicks increasingly inconvenient.
Oh, okay.
It required special, like the Tingler, required special installations.
House on Haunted Hill, of course, yeah.
House on Haunted Hill, rigging like a midnight spook show, and so on and so forth. And a lot of the pictures required, here are your special viewing glasses if you want to see certain portions of the picture tampered with, and finally, you know, it's like, enough with the gimmicks, just tell the story, which is probably a logical conclusion to that.
But he couldn't get away from the gimmicks, could he?
No, but once he had attained the attention, it was hard to let go of, and I think, you talk about the Hitchcock comparison. Hitchcock was his own gimmick.
Right.
Castle was no Hitchcock, but that doesn't make him a lesser figure. He was merely a carnival sideshow spieler, where Castle was an honest-to-gosh filmmaker. Hitchcock. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Hitchcock.
Where the two differ is not in terms of subject matter or interest in being a personality related to their own films, but in the fact that Alfred Hitchcock came up the hard way, Castle came up a different hard way, that is, cranking out B movies for Columbia and Monogram.
Right.
And didn't have the kind of background that Hitchcock had, but once he had his hits start coming in, he started, I can do Hitchcock, I can be Hitchcock, I will be the master of suspense. It was like, maybe there's room for more than one master of suspense.
Right. Yeah, it could be. Well, I'll tell you what, he did take a topic that was trumpeted in the posters for I Saw What You Did, and that is oxoricide. Am I saying that right? Uxoricide?
Uxoricide.
Uxoricide, which he ballyhooed on the posters. This film is about uxoricide, which, of course, is killing your wife. And sure enough, it was as advertised, but it's also about a lot of other things besides that. It's we don't want to make any more of it, I don't think, than what it is, which is a pretty diverting little picture. It's got some... It's instructive now. I kind of wonder what today's teenagers would think of those teenagers, because they seem awfully silly. in a lot of ways, and awfully, awfully immature and silly, and you know, I don't know what you know what another what the upcoming generation would think about that, but it's I don't even think it's one of Castle's best pictures, but there's sure some nice moments in it.
Oh yeah, including that still very shocking murder scene.
That's right. That's right.
Including the air of like almost like a moral sickness pervading this very normal middle class community.
Mm-hmm. It's like, again, does that remind you of Blue Velvet?
Sure,
sure.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, well, you never know who your neighbor might be.
Right, right. And the friendly fireman waving from the back of the truck. That's right.
Right.
I don't know how easy this is to find, Joey. Is this a pretty hard picture to find, you know?
There's a cheap DVD and a new Blu-ray.
A new Blu-ray.
Yeah.
And a cheap DVD.
It looks great.
Excellent.
And I think it will be a good thing if people haven't seen it. It might be a good William Castle picture to see. It's interesting. And it's, you know.
There's no bad William Castle picture to see.
No, because the only bad film is a boring film. You know, The Busybody comes close a little bit, I think. But other than that, I think we're okay on. And Tom Poston's Old Dark House. Nah, it's okay. It's okay too. It's worth watching.
It's exactly.
Speaking of worth watching, tell us now. We've reached the point where we'd like to talk about some of the stuff we've got out there. If people are interested in perusing our printed output, what's the latest on the Forgotten Horrors? I know you got through. You're in the middle of 13 now. What's the latest one you have out?
Well, the latest in print is jumping the gun a little bit. 13 is a bit of a stretch, because there will be intervening numbers. But, you know, we're still riding high with numbers 9 and 10. The one I'm really excited about right now is a new Music of Forgotten Horrors
CD. Oh, nice. Good. Where's that come from?
That's going to... This one is entirely my creepy novelty recordings that have appeared on the Dr. Demento show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good.
So that goes all the way back to the early 1990s and brings it all the way up through the present, including a stage dramatization that Josh Allen Friedman and I did a couple of years ago of an Arch Obler radio play.
Oh, very good. That was
a lot of...
What's it called? The Dark?
The Dark. You know the story,
mm-hmm,
The Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. From Lights Out?
That's from Lights Out and from his recreated album called Drop Dead.
Yeah, that's right, right.
Which which scared the bejesus out of me when I was a kid.
Boy, me too. I've still got my copy. You still got yours?
Still have. Mm-hmm. Still have. Yes, indeed. In fact, Josh and I studied that when we were getting ready to do the live version, and I think we kept it faithful, but we added some variations of our own, and then the whole package. I think it's going to be a cram packed 80-minute CD of mostly goofy horrific novelties.
Well, you know, are you going to have my favorite of yours of those novelties on the disc, Up Jurassic Park?
Up Jurassic Park, which was I think one of the Dr. Demento top 5 selections.
Oh, it's a dandy
original play.
It's
and of
dandy.
Course, it's just there's you forget how many of these things you've done over the long term.
Right, right.
And you go back to the catalog of master tapes, and it's like, oh, I remember that one. It's been a long time. And that leads me to believe that a lot of people may not have ever heard some of these things.
Well, you're doing your Giant Leeches. You're doing your Giant Leeches piece, right?
Well, the Leeches and the Killer Shrews.
Good. Good. Excellent.
Yeah, that Leeches piece is actually a song that was written for... not to appear in the movie, but to promote the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Anson did such a perfect job of the imitation Peter Lorre voice on the Leeches. It's like, don't mess with that. So I rewrote the thing as a hip-hop
yes.
piece.
Yes, and it works very well.
It works, yeah. Everything falls into place. But what about yourself? What's cooking on that front?
Well, thanks, I'm sure, in part to your wonderful flap copy. We're doing pretty well with the first of our horror trilogy, the first book in our horror trilogy called A Cleansing, first book called Seventh Sense. From Robert Brown, my old friend Robert Brown and I wrote it, set in 1939 Arkansas in the hills. It's an epistolary novel. We've got some great reviews, and again, I can't thank you enough for the flap copy you gave us, because you nailed it. We were going for kind of a Weird Tales vibe, Weird Tales pulp vibe. And you found that immediately, and we really appreciate that. We've got now some online, some reviews that have come out that are very complimentary toward it, and we're very happy with it, and it's doing very well. I just had a book signing at Magic City Books in Tulsa last night, as a matter of fact. And it's just really, it just really seems to be doing well. And I want to thank everybody, because this is a tough, you know, it's tough having, as you well know, Lord, nobody knows better than you. It's pretty tough having books out in today's market. We've talked about this on and off the air, and sometimes on the air we're supposed to be off the air, as I understand it from Joey. But it's very hard to rise above the noise of the self-published that maybe haven't quite paid enough dues to be out there, you know, competing with the other material, if I can be euphemistic, if that's euphemistic enough. So it's working out very well. I have to say, hadn't been out that long. Fantasies in the Sand is doing well, and I'm very happy that you gave me that opportunity, and you and I collaborated on that one. It's basically, the thesis was to take the Beach Party films as fantasy films, and what we did, and that seems to have worked as well. So I'm just pretty happy about all of that. Now, is the music is your album out, the CD out now, or is it getting ready to come out?
I'm just finishing the cover design, and the digital audio files have been selected, transferred to the master disc, and now need to go through a little tweaking and editing. The technology has changed enough in the past 10 years that I've found myself having to learn several new methods of audio file creation. Mm. It was like, okay, just when I get this learning curve finished, another one crops up.
Right.
But it's always worth the trouble.
Sure.
We're talking about doing download editions of the music CDs.
Oh, nice.
Which I'm sure I'm probably about a generation behind the times on that. But I still believe that the fans, the genuine fans that serve to keep us in business, kind of like the feel of having a real book or a real CD or phonograph record in their hands.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to think so, too. And, you know, we're streaming. No, not streaming. That's not right. What are we doing with Bill Boyce, Joey? That's a download, right?
No, it's for streaming.
It's for streaming.
Yeah, you're on that. You're on that newer wavelength.
Well, yeah, but actually, I had to ask Joey what we were doing because I had no idea. But that's a documentary.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I once you master the art of storytelling and get to the point where people want to read the stories you have to tell, then it's kind of tempting not to learn new methods of telling those stories.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I'm afraid you got me there. We're going to be telling a story next time about, because we're sort of making our own rules. And, of course, we always like to hear from people on our Facebook page, right, the Forgotten Horrors Podcast.
Yeah.
And if you want us to chew on some film, we'll be glad to do that.
Absolutely.
When we're left to our own devices, we kind of range far afield. And this one, we were talking about this before we started doing the podcast, Michael, and this is a film I thought was maybe almost too well known to be a Forgotten Horrors podcast subject, but you have dissuaded me from that opinion. That it's not all that well known.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, and that is Repo Man, the film Repo
Definitely. I don't often use the term cult film, but by the true narrow definition of cult film, Repo Man fits. Mm-hmm. And it also is a damned weird piece of movie making.
Well, you know, I have to say, as much of a Michael Nesmith fan as I am, who I think produced it, is that correct? Was that Pacific Arts film?
Yes.
Yeah, under his company, Pacific Arts. I'm a huge Michael Nesmith fan, but I have never seen Repo Man. So this will give me an opportunity to take a look at it and maybe put some fresh eyes on it. You've obviously seen it. Our producer Joey has seen it, so I'm late to coming to that party. But I think it should be fun. It sounds like a great picture.
Well, it's and you can see here that watching this film that Harry Dean Stanton doesn't need David Lynch to make him weird.
Right. Well, we'll have further insights along those lines next time, folks. Thank you, meanwhile, for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. That's Michael Price. I'm John Woolley. As always, we appreciate it very much. Please come back and visit us.
There you go.